All of it put a big dark crimp in the day. And there was another gloomy idea rolling around inside my head, the idea that this was no lark after all, and maybe we deserved our bad luck. Maybe it was even God warning us to go home. What were we doing, anyway? Going to look at some kid that had gotten himself all mashed up by a freight train? But we were doing it, and none of us wanted to stop. We had almost reached the trestle which carried the tracks across the river when Teddy burst into tears. It was as if a great inner tidal wave had broken through a carefully constructed set of mental dikes. No bullshit. It was that sudden and that fierce. The sobs doubled him over like punches, and he sort of collapsed into a heap, his hands going from his stomach to the mutilated gobs of flesh that were the remains of his ears. He went on crying in hard, violent bursts. None of us knew what the fuck to do. It wasn't crying like when you got hit by a line drive while you were playing shortstop, or smashed on the head playing tackle football on the common, or when you fell off your bike. There was nothing physically wrong with him. We walked away a little and watched him, our hands in our pockets. "Hey, man," Vern said in a very thin voice. Chris and I looked at Vern hopefully. "Hey, man" was always a good start, but Vern couldn't follow it up. Teddy leaned forward onto the cross ties and put a hand over his eyes. Now he looked like he was doing the Allah bit. Salami, salami, baloney, as Popeye says, except it wasn't funny. At last, when the force of his crying had trailed off a little, it was Chris who went to him. He was the toughest guy in our gang, maybe even tougher than Jamie Gallant, I thought privately, but he was also the guy who made the best peace. He had a way about it. I'd seen him sit down on the curb next to a little kid with a scraped knee, a kid he didn't even fucking know, and get him talking about something, the Shrine Circus that was coming to town, or Huckleberry Hound on TV, until the kid forgot he was supposed to be hurt. Chris was good at it. He was tough enough to be good at it. "Listen, Teddy, what do you care what a fat old pile of shit like him said about your father? Huh? I mean, sincerely. That don't change nothing, does it? What a fat old pile of shit like him says, huh? Huh? Does it?" Teddy shook his head violently. It changed nothing. But to hear it spoken of, in bright daylight, something he must have gone over and over in his mind while he was lying awake in bed and looking at the moon off-center in one window pane, something he must have thought of in his slow and broken way until it seemed almost holy, trying to make sense out of it, and then to have it brought home to him, that everybody else had merely dismissed his dad as a loony, that had rocked him. But it changed nothing. Nothing. "He still stormed the beach at Normandy, right?" Chris said. He picked up one of Teddy's sweaty, grimy hands and patted it. Teddy nodded fiercely, crying. Snot was running out of his nose. "Do you think that pile of shit was at Normandy?" Teddy shook his head violently. "No. Do you think that guy knows you?" No, but... "Or your father? He one of your father's buddies?" "No!" Angry, horrified. The thought... Teddy's chest heaved, and more sobs came out of it. He had pushed his hair away from his ears, and I could see the round, brown plastic button of the hearing aid set in the middle of his right one. The shape of the hearing aid made more sense than the shape of his ear, if you get what I mean. Chris said calmly, "Talk is cheap." Teddy nodded, still not looking up. "And whatever's between you and your old man, talk can't change that." Teddy's head shook, without definition, unsure if this was true. Someone had redefined his pain, and redefined it in shockingly common terms. That would, loony, have to be examined fucking Section 8 later, in depth, on long, sleepless nights. Chris rocked him. "He was ranking you, man," he said in soothing cadences that were almost a lullaby. "He was trying to rank you over that friggin' fence, you know it? No strain, man, no fucking strain. He don't know nothing about your old man. He don't know nothing but stuff he heard from those rum-dums down at the Mellow Tiger. He's just dog shit, man. Right, Teddy? Huh? Right?" Teddy's crying was down to sniffles. He wiped his eyes, leaving two sooty rings around them, and sat up. "I'm okay," he said. and the sound of his own voice seemed to convince him. "Yeah, I'm okay." He stood up and put his glasses back on, dressing his naked face, it seemed to me. He laughed thinly and swiped his bare arm across the snout of his upper lip. "Fucking crybaby, right?" "No, man," Vern said uncomfortably. "If anyone was ranking out my dad, then you gotta kill him," Teddy said briskly, almost arrogantly. "Kill their asses, right, Chris?" "Right," Chris said amiably, and clapped Teddy on the back. "Right, Gordy?" "Absolutely," I said, wondering how Teddy could care so much for his dad when his dad had practically killed him, and how I couldn't seem to give much of a shit one way or another about my own dad, when so far as I could remember he had never laid a hand on me since I was 3 and got some bleach from under the sink and started to eat it. We walked another 200 yards down the tracks, and Teddy said in a quieter voice, "Hey, if I spoiled your good time, I'm sorry. I guess that was pretty stupid shit back there at the fence." "I ain't sure I want it to be no good time," Vern said suddenly. Chris looked at him. "You saying you want to go back, man?" "No, uh-uh." Vern's face nodded in thought. "But going to see a dead kid, it shouldn't be a party, maybe. I mean, if you can dig it. I mean," he looked at us rather wildly, "I mean, I could be a little scared, if you get me." Nobody said anything, and Vern plunged on. "I mean, sometimes I get nightmares, like, oh, you guys remember the time Danny Naughton left that pile of old funny books, the ones with the vampires and people getting cut up and all that shit? Jeez, I'm crow. I wake up in the middle of the night dreaming about some guy hanging in a house with his face all green or something, you know, like that. And it seems like there's something under the bed, and if I dangled a hand over the side, that thing might, you know, grab me." We all began to nod. We knew about the night shift. I would have laughed then, though, if you had told me that one day, not too many years from then, I'd parlay all those childhood fears and night sweats into about $1 million. "And I don't dare say anything because my friggin' brother, well, you know Billy, he'll broadcast it." He shrugged miserably. "So I'm scared to look at that kid, because if he's, you know, if he's really bad..." I swallowed and glanced at Chris. He was looking gravely at Vern and nodding for him to go on. "If he's really bad," Vern resumed, "I'll have nightmares about him, and wake up thinking it's him under my bed, all cut up in a pool of blood like he just came out of one of those Salad Master gadgets they show on TV, just eyeballs and hair, but moving somehow, if you can dig that, moving somehow, you know, and getting ready to grab." "Jesus Christ," Teddy said thickly. "What a fucking bedtime story." "Well, I can't help it," Vern said, his voice defensive. "But I feel like we have to see him, even if there are bad dreams, you know? Like, we have to. But maybe it shouldn't be no good time." "Yeah," Chris said softly. "Maybe it shouldn't." Vern said pleadingly, "You won't tell none of the other guys, will you? I don't mean about the nightmares. Everybody has those. I mean about waking up and thinking there might be something under the bed. I'm too fucking old for the boogeyman." We all said we wouldn't tell, and a glum silence fell over us again. It was only 2:45, but it felt much later. It was too hot, and too much had happened. We weren't even over into Harlow yet. We were going to have to pick them up and lay them down if we were going to make some real miles before dark. We passed the railroad junction and a signal on a tall, rusty pole, and all of us paused to chuck cinders at the steel flag on top, but nobody hit it. And around 3:30, we came to the Castle River and the GS and WM trestle, which crossed it. 14. The river was better than 100 yards across at that point in 1960. I've been back to look at it since then and found it had narrowed up quite a bit during the years between. They're always fooling with the river, trying to make it work better for the mills, and they've put in so many dams that it's pretty well tamed. But in those days, there were only 3 dams on the whole length of the river as it ran across New Hampshire and half of Maine. The castle was still almost free back then, and every 3rd spring it would overflow its banks and cover Route 136 in either Harlow or Danvers Junction or both. Now, at the end of the driest summer western Maine had seen since the Depression, it was still broad. From where we stood on the Castle Rock side, the bulking forest on the Harlow side looked like a different country altogether. The pines and spruces over there were bluish in the heat haze of the afternoon, The rails went across the water 50 feet up, supported by an underpinning of tarred wooden support posts and crisscrossing beams. The water was so shallow you could look down and see the tops of the cement plugs, which had been planted 10 feet deep in the riverbed to hold up the trestle. The trestle itself was pretty chintzy. The rails ran over a long, narrow wooden platform of 6x4s. There was a 4-inch gap between each pair of these beams where you could look all the way down into the water. On the sides, there was no more than 18 inches between the rail and the edge of the trestle. If a train came, it was maybe enough room to avoid getting plastered, but the wind generated by a high-balling freight would surely sweep you off to fall to a certain death against the rocks just below the surface of the shallow running water. Looking at the trestle, we all felt fear start to crawl around in our bellies, and mixing uneasily with the fear was the excitement of a boss dare, a really big one, something you could brag on for weeks after you got home, if you got home. That queer light was creeping back into Teddy's eyes, and I thought he wasn't seeing the GS and WM train trestle at all, but a long sandy beach, 1,000 LSTs aground in the foaming waves, 10,000 GIs charging up the sand, combat boots digging. They were leaping rolls of barbed wire, tossing grenades at pillboxes, overrunning machine gun nests. We were standing beside the tracks, where the cinders sloped away toward the river's cut, the place where the embankment stopped and the trestle began. Looking down, I could see where the slope started to get steep. The cinders gave way to scraggly, tough-looking bushes and slabs of gray rock. Further down, there were a few stunted firs with exposed roots writhing their way out of fissures in the plates of rock. They seemed to be looking down at their own miserable reflections in the running water. At this point, the Castle River actually looked fairly clean. At Castle Rock, it was just entering Maine's textile mill belt. But there were no fish jumping out there. Although the river was clear enough to see bottom, you had to go another 10 miles upstream and toward New Hampshire before you could see any fish in the castle. There were no fish, and along the edges of the river you could see dirty collars of foam around some of the rocks. The foam was the color of old ivory. The river's smell was not particularly pleasant either. It smelled like a laundry hamper full of mildewy towels. Dragonflies stitched at the surface of the water and laid their eggs with impunity. There were no trout to eat them. Hell, there weren't even any shiners. Man, Chris said softly. Come on, Teddy said in that brisk, arrogant way. Let's go. He was already edging his way out, walking on the 6x4s between the shining rails. Say, Vern said uneasily, any of you guys know when the next train's due? We all shrugged. I said, there's the Route 136 bridge. Hey, come on, give me a break, Teddy cried. That means walking 5 miles down the river on this side and then 5 miles back up on the other side. It'll take us until dark. If we use the trestle, we can get to the same place in 10 minutes. But if a train comes, there's nowheres to go, Vern said. He wasn't looking at Teddy. He was looking down at the fast, bland river. Fuck there isn't, Teddy said indignantly. He swung over the edge and held one of the wooden supports between the rails. He hadn't gone out very far. His sneakers were almost touching the ground, but the thought of doing that same thing above the middle of the river with a 50-foot drop beneath and a train bellowing by just over my head, a train that would probably be dropping some nice hot sparks into my hair and down the back of my neck, none of that actually made me feel like queen for a day. See how easy it is? Teddy said. He dropped to the embankment, dusted his hands, and climbed back up beside us. You telling me you're going to hang on that way if it's a 200-car freight? Chris asked. Just sort of hang there by your hands for 5 or 10 minutes? You chicken? Teddy shouted. No, just asking what you'd do, Chris said, grinning. Peace, man. Go around if you want to, Teddy brayed. Who gives a fuck? I'll wait for you. I'll take a nap. One train already went by, I said reluctantly, and there probably isn't any more than 1-2 trains a day that go through Harlow. Look at this. I kicked the weeds growing up through the railroad ties with one sneaker. There were no weeds growing between the tracks which ran between Castle Rock and Lewiston. There. See? Teddy, triumphant. But still, there's a chance, I added. Yeah, Chris said. He was looking only at me, his eyes sparkling. Dare you, LaChance? Dares go first. Okay, Chris said. He widened his gaze to take in Teddy and Vern. Any pussies here? No, Teddy shouted. Vern cleared his throat, croaked, cleared it again, and said, no, in a very small voice. He smiled a weak, sick smile. Okay, Chris said. But we hesitated for a moment, even Teddy, looking warily up and down the tracks. I knelt down and took one of the steel rails firmly in my hand, never minding that it was almost hot enough to blister the skin. The rail was mute. Okay, I said, and as I said it, some guy pole-vaulted in my stomach. He dug his pole all the way into my balls, it felt like, and ended up sitting astride my heart. We went out onto the trestle, single file. Chris first, then Teddy, then Vern, and me playing tail-end Charlie because I was the one who said dares go first. We walked on the platform cross-ties between the rails, and you had to look at your feet whether you were scared of heights or not. A misstep, and you would go down to your crotch, probably with a broken ankle to pay. The embankment dropped away beneath me, and every step further out seemed to seal our decision more firmly, and to make it feel more suicidally stupid. I stopped to look up when I saw the rocks giving way to water far beneath me. Chris and Teddy were a long way ahead, almost out over the middle, and Vern was tottering slowly along behind them, peering studiously down at his feet. He looked like an old lady trying out stilts, with his head poked downward, his back hunched, his arms held out for balance. I looked back over my shoulder. Too far, man. I had to keep going now, and not only because a train might come. If I went back, I'd be a pussy for life. So I got walking again. After looking down at that endless series of crossties for a while, with a glimpse of running water between each pair, I started to feel dizzy and disoriented. Each time I brought my foot down, part of my brain assured me it was going to plunge through into space, even though I could see it was not. I became acutely aware of all the noises inside me and outside me, like some crazy orchestra tuning up to play. The steady thump of my heart, the blood beat in my ears like a drum being played with brushes, the creak of sinews like the strings of a violin that has been tuned radically upward, the steady hiss of the river, the hot hum of a locust digging into tight bark, the monotonous cry of a chickadee, and somewhere, far away, a barking dog. Chopper, maybe. The mildewy smell of the Castle River was strong in my nose. The long muscles in my thighs were trembling. I kept thinking how much safer it would be, probably faster as well, if I just got down on my hands and knees and scuttered along that way. But I wouldn't do that. None of us would. If the Saturday matinee movies down at the Gem had taught us anything, it was that only losers crawl. It was one of the central tenets of the Gospel According to Hollywood. Good guys walk firmly upright. And if your sinews are creaking like overtuned violin strings because of the adrenaline rush going on in your body, and if the long muscles in your thighs are trembling for the same reason, why, so be it. I had to stop in the middle of the trestle and look up at the sky for a while. That dizzy feeling had been getting worse. I saw phantom cross-ties. They seemed to float right in front of my nose. Then they faded out, and I began to feel okay again. I looked ahead and saw I had almost caught up with Vern, who was slow-poking along worse than ever. Chris and Teddy were almost all the way across. And although I've since written 7 books about people who can do such exotic things as read minds and precognite the future, that was when I had my first and last psychic flash. I'm sure that's what it was. How else to explain it? I squatted and made a fist around the rail on my left. It thrummed in my hand. It was thrumming so hard that it was like gripping a bundle of deadly metallic snakes. You've heard it said, his bowels turned to water. I know what that phrase means. Exactly what it means. It may be the most accurate cliché ever coined. I've been scared since. Badly scared, but I've never been as scared as I was in that moment holding that hot live rail. It seemed that for a moment all my works below throat level just went limp and lay there in an internal faint. A thin stream of urine ran listlessly down the inside of one thigh. My mouth opened. I didn't open it. It opened by itself, the jar dropping like a trap door from which the hinge pins had suddenly been removed. My tongue was plastered suffocatingly against the roof of my mouth. All my muscles were locked. That was the worst. My works went limp, but my muscles were in a kind of dreadful lock bolt, and I couldn't move at all. It was only for a moment, but in the subjective time stream it seemed forever. All sensory input became intensified, as if some power surge had occurred in the electrical flow of my brain, cranking everything up from 110 volts to 220. I could hear a plane passing in the sky somewhere near and had time to wish I was on it, just sitting in a window seat with a Coke in my hand and gazing idly down at the shining line of a river whose name I did not know. I could see every little splinter and gouge in the tarred cross-tie I was squatting on, and out of the corner of my eye I could see the rail itself with my hand still clutched around it, glittering insanely. The vibration from that rail sank so deeply into my hand that when I took it away it still vibrated, the nerve endings kicking each other over and over again, tingling the way a hand or foot tingles when it has been asleep and is starting to wake up. I could taste my saliva, suddenly all electric and sour and thickened to curds along my gums. And worst, somehow most horrible of all, I couldn't hear the train yet. Could not know if it was rushing at me from ahead or behind or how close it was. It was invisible. It was unannounced, except for that shaking rail. There was only that to advertise its imminent arrival, an image of Ray Brower, dreadfully mangled and thrown into a ditch somewhere like a ripped-open laundry bag, reeled before my eyes. We would join him, or at least Vern and I would, or at least I would. We had invited ourselves to our own funerals. The last thought broke the paralysis, and I shot to my feet. I probably would have looked like a jack-in-the-box to anyone watching, but to myself I felt like a boy in underwater slow motion, shooting up not through 5 feet of air, but rather up through 500 feet of water, moving slowly, moving with a dreadful languidness as the water parted grudgingly. But at last I did break the surface. I screamed, "Train!" The last of the paralysis fell from me, and I began to run. Vern's head jerked back over his shoulder. The surprise that distorted his face was almost comically exaggerated, written as large as the letters in a Dick and Jane primer. He saw me break into my clumsy, shambling run, dancing from one horribly high cross-tie to the next, and knew I wasn't joking. He began to run himself. Far ahead I could see Chris stepping off the ties and onto the solid safe embankment, and I hated him with a sudden bright green hate, as juicy and as bitter as the sap in an April leaf. He was safe. That fucker was safe. I watched him drop to his knees and grab a rail. My left foot almost slipped into the yaw beneath me. I flailed with my arms, my eyes as hot as ball bearings in some runaway piece of machinery, got my balance, and ran on. Now I was right behind Vern. We were past the halfway point, and for the first time I heard the train. It was coming from behind us, coming from the Castle Rock side of the river. It was a low, rumbling noise that began to rise slightly and sort itself into the diesel thrum of the engine and the higher, more sinister sound of big, grooved wheels turning heavily on the rails. "Aw, shit!" Vern screamed. "Run, you pussy!" I yelled and thumped him on the back. "I can't! I'll fall! Run faster! Aw, shit!" But he ran faster, a shambling scarecrow with a bare, sunburnt back, the collar of his shirt swinging and dangling below his butt. I could see the sweat standing out on his peeling shoulder blades, standing out in perfect little beads. I could see the fine down on the nape of his neck, his muscles clenched and loosened, clenched and loosened. His spine stood out in a series of knobs, each knob casting its own crescent-shaped shadow. I could see that these knobs grew closer together as they approached his neck. He was still holding his bedroll, and I was still holding mine. Vern's feet thudded on the cross-ties. He almost missed one, lunged forward with his arms out, and I whacked him on the back again to keep him going. "Gordy, I can't! Aw, shit! Run faster, dickface," I bellowed, and I was enjoying this? Yeah, in some peculiar, self-destructive way. that I have experienced since only when completely and utterly drunk, I was. I was driving Vern Tessier like a drover, getting a particularly fine cow to market. And maybe he was enjoying his own fear in that same way, bawling like that self-same cow, hollering and sweating, his ribcage rising and falling like the bellows of a blacksmith on a speed trip, clumsily keeping his footing, lurching ahead. The train was very loud now, its engine deepening to a steady rumble. Its whistle sounded as it crossed the junction point where we had paused to chuck cinders at the rail flag. I had finally gotten my hellhound, like it or not. I kept waiting for the trestle to start shaking under my feet. When that happened, it would be right behind us. "Go faster, Vern! Faster! Oh, God, Gordy! Oh, God, Gordy! Oh, shit! The freight's electric horn suddenly spanked the air into 100 pieces with one long, loud blast, making everything you ever saw in a movie or a comic book or one of your own daydreams fly apart, letting you know what both the heroes and the cowards really heard when death flew at them. Wonk! Wonk! And then Chris was below us and to the right, and Teddy was behind him, his glasses flashing back arcs of sunlight, and they were both mouthing a single word, and the word was jump. But the train had sucked all the blood out of the word, leaving only its shape in their mouths. The trestle began to shake as the train charged across it. We jumped. Vern landed full length in the dust and the cinders, and I landed right beside him, almost on top of him. I never did see that train, nor do I know if its engineer saw us. When I mentioned the possibility that he hadn't seen us to Chris a couple of years later, he said, "They don't blow the horn like that just for chucks, Gordy." But he could have. He could have been blowing it just for the hell of it, I suppose. Right then, such fine points didn't much matter. I clapped my hands over my ears and dug my face into the hot dirt as the freight went by, metal squalling against metal, the air buffeting us. I had no urge to look at it. It was a long freight, but I never looked at all. Before it had passed completely, I felt a warm hand on my neck. I knew it was Chris's. When it was gone, when I was sure it was gone, I raised my head like a soldier coming out of his foxhole at the end of a day-long artillery barrage. Vern was still plastered into the dirt, shivering. Chris was sitting cross-legged between us, one hand on Vern's sweaty neck, the other still on mine. When Vern finally sat up, shaking all over and licking his lips compulsively, Chris said, "What do you guys think if we drink those Cokes? Can anybody use one besides me?" We all thought we could use one. About a quarter of a mile along on the Harlow side, the GS and WM tracks plunged directly into the woods. The heavily wooded land sloped down to a marshy area. It was full of mosquitoes, almost as big as fighter planes, but it was cool, blessedly cool. We sat down in the shade to drink our Cokes. Vern and I threw our shirts over our shoulders to keep the bugs off, but Chris and Teddy just sat naked to the waist, looking as cool and collected as two Eskimos in an ice house. We hadn't been there 5 minutes when Vern had to go off into the bushes and take a squat, which led to a good deal of joking and elbowing when he got back. "Train scare you much, Vern?" "No," Vern said. "I was going to squat when we got across anyway. I had to take a squat, you know." "Vern," Chris and Teddy chorused. "Come on, you guys, I did, sincerely." "Then you won't mind if we examine the seat of your jockeys for Hershey squirts, will you?" Teddy asked. And Vern laughed, finally understanding that he was getting ribbed. "Go screw," Chris turned to me. "That train scare you, Gordy?" "Nope," I said and sipped my Coke. "Not much, you sucker," he punched my arm. "Sincerely, I wasn't scared at all." "Yeah? You wasn't scared?" Teddy was looking me over carefully. "No, I was fucking petrified." This slew all of them, even Vern, and we laughed long and hard. Then we just lay back, not goofing anymore, just drinking our Cokes and being quiet. My body felt warm, exercised, at peace with itself. Nothing in it was working cross-grained to anything else. I was alive and glad to be. Everything seemed to stand out with a special dearness, and although I never could have said that out loud, I didn't think it mattered. Maybe that sense of dearness was something I wanted just for myself. I think I began to understand a little bit that day what makes men become daredevils. I paid $20 to watch Evel Knievel attempt his jump over the Snake River Canyon a couple of years ago, and my wife was horrified. She told me that if I'd been born a Roman, I would have been right there in the Colosseum munching grapes and watching as the lions disemboweled the Christians. She was wrong, although it was hard for me to explain why, and really I think she thought I was just jiving her. I didn't cough up that 20 to watch the man die on coast-to-coast closed-circuit TV, although I was quite sure that was exactly what was going to happen. I went because of the shadows that are always somewhere behind our eyes, because of what Bruce Springsteen calls the darkness on the edge of town in one of his songs, and at one time or another, I think everyone wants to dare that darkness in spite of the jalopy bodies that some joker of a god gave us human beings. No, not in spite of our jalopy bodies, but because of them. "Hey, tell that story," Chris said, suddenly sitting up. "What story?" I asked, although I guess I knew. I always felt uncomfortable when the talk turned to my stories, although all of them seemed to like them, wanting to tell stories, even wanting to write them down. That was just peculiar enough to be sort of cool, like wanting to grow up to be a sewer inspector or a Grand Prix mechanic. Richie Jenner, a kid who hung around with us until his family moved to Nebraska in 1959, was the first one to find out that I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, that I wanted to do that for my full-time job. We were up in my room, just fooling around, and he found a bunch of handwritten pages under the comic books in a carton in my closet. "What's this?" Richie asks. "Nothing," I say, and try to grab them back. Richie held the pages up out of reach, and I must admit that I didn't try very hard to get them back. I wanted him to read them, and at the same time I didn't. An uneasy mix of pride and shyness that has never changed in me very much when someone asks to look. The act of writing itself is done in secret, like masturbation. Oh, I have one friend who has done things like write stories in the display windows of bookshops and department stores, but this is a man who is nearly crazy with courage, the kind of man you'd like to have with you if you just happened to fall down with a heart attack in a city where no one knew you. For me, it always wants to be sex and always falls short. It's always that adolescent handjob in the bathroom with the door locked. Richie sat right there on the edge of my bed for most of the afternoon, reading his way through the stuff I had been doing, most of it influenced by the very same sort of comic books as the ones that had given Vern nightmares. And when he was done, Richie looked at me in a strange new way that made me feel very peculiar, as if he had been forced to reappraise my whole personality. He said, "You're pretty good at this. Why don't you show these to Chris?" I said, "No, I wanted it to be a secret." And Richie said, "Why? It ain't pussy. You ain't no queer. I mean, it ain't poetry." Still, I made him promise not to tell anybody about my stories. And of course he did. And it turned out most of them liked to read the stuff I wrote, which was mostly about getting buried alive or some crook coming back from the dead and slaughtering the juries that had condemned him in 12 interesting ways, or a maniac that went crazy and chopped a lot of people into veal cutlets before the hero, Kurt Cannon, cut the subhuman screeching madman to pieces with round after round from his smoking 45 automatic. In my stories, there were always rounds, never bullets. For a change of pace, there were the Ledillo stories. Ledillo was a town in France, and during 1942, a grim squad of tired American dog faces were trying to retake it from the Nazis. This was 2 years before I discovered that the Allies didn't land in France until 1944. They went on trying to retake it, fighting their way from street to street through about 40 stories, which I wrote between the ages of 9 and 14. Teddy was absolutely mad for the Ledillo stories, and I think I wrote the last dozen or so just for him. By then I was heartily sick of Ledillo and writing things like Mon Dieu and Cherchez la Boche and Fermez la Porte. In Ledillo, French peasants were always hissing to GI dog faces to Fermez la Porte. But Teddy would hunch over the pages, his eyes big, his brow beaded with sweat, his face twisting. There were times when I can almost hear air-cooled Brownings and whistling 88s going off in his skull. The way he clamored for more Ledillo stories was both pleasing and frightening. Nowadays, writing is my work, and the pleasure has diminished a little. and more often that guilty, masturbatory pleasure has become associated in my head with the coldly clinical images of artificial insemination. I come according to the rules and regs laid down in my publishing contract. And although no one is ever going to call me the Thomas Wolfe of my generation, I rarely feel like a cheat. I get it off as hard as I can every fucking time. Doing less would, in an odd way, be like going faggot, or what that meant to us back then. What scares me is how often it hurts these days. Back then I was sometimes disgusted by how damn good it felt to write. These days, I sometimes look at this typewriter and wonder when it's going to run out of good words. I don't want that to happen. I guess I can stay cool as long as I don't run out of good words, you know. What's this story? Vern asked uneasily. It ain't a horror story, is it, Gordy? I don't think I want to hear no horror stories. I'm not up for that, man. No, it ain't a horror, Chris said. It's really funny. Gross, but funny. Go on, Gordy, hammer that fucker to us. Is it about Lidio? Teddy asked. No, it ain't about Lidio, you psycho, Chris said, and Rabbit punched him. It's about this pie-eating contest. Hey, I didn't even write it down yet, I said. Yeah, but tell it. You guys want to hear it? Sure, Teddy said. Boss. Well, it's about this made-up town. Gretna, I call it. Gretna, Maine. Gretna? Vern said, grinning. What kind of name is that? There ain't no Gretna in Maine. Shut up, fool, Chris said. He just told you it was made up, didn't he? Yeah, but Gretna, that sounds pretty stupid. Lots of real towns sound stupid, Chris said. I mean, what about Alfred, Maine, or Saco, Maine, or Jerusalem's Lot, or Castle fucking Rock? There ain't no castle here. Most town names are stupid. You just don't think so because you're used to them, right, Gordy? Sure, I said. But privately, I thought Vern was right. Gretna was a pretty stupid name for a town. I just hadn't been able to think of another one. So, anyway, they're having their annual Pioneer Days, just like in Castle Rock. Yeah, Pioneer Days, that's a fucking blast, Vern said earnestly. I put my whole family in that jail on wheels they have, even fucking Billy. It was only for half an hour, and it cost me my whole allowance, but it was worth it just to know where the son of a whore was. Will you shut up and let him tell it? Teddy hollered. Vern blinked. Sure, yeah. Okay. Go on, Gordy, Chris said. It's not really much. Nah, we don't expect much from a wet end like you, Teddy said, but tell it anyway. I cleared my throat. So, anyway, it's Pioneer Days, and on the last night they have these three big events. There's an egg roll for little kids and a sack race for kids that are like 8 or 9, and then there's the pie-eating contest. And the main guy of the story is this fat kid nobody likes named Davy Hogan. Like Charlie Hogan's brother if he had one, Vern said, and then shrank back as Chris Rabbit punched him again. This kid, he's our age, but he's fat. He weighs like 180, and he's always getting beat up and ranked out. And all the kids, instead of calling him Davy, they call him Lard-Ass Hogan and rank him out whenever they get the chance. They nodded respectfully, showing the proper sympathy for Lard-Ass, although if such a guy ever showed up in Castle Rock, we all would have been out teasing him and ranking him to the dogs and back. So he decides to take revenge, because he's, like, fed up, you know. He's only in the pie-eating contest, but that's like the final event during Pioneer Days, and everyone really digs it. The prize is $5. So he wins it and gives a finger to everybody, Teddy said. Boss! No, it's better than that, Chris said. Just shut up and listen. Lard-Ass figures to himself, $5, what's that? If anybody remembers anything at all in 2 weeks, it'll just be that fucking pig Hogan out-ate everybody. Well, it figures. Let's go over to his house and rank the shit out of him. Only now we'll call him Pie-Ass instead of Lard-Ass. They nodded some more, agreeing that Davy Hogan was a thinking cat. I began to warm to my own story. But everybody expects him to enter the contest, you know, even his mom and dad. Hey, they practically got that $5 spent for him already. Yeah, right, Chris said. So he's thinking about it and hating the whole thing because being fat isn't really his fault. See, he's got these weird fucking glands something. And my cousin's like that, Vern said excitedly. Sincerely, she weighs close to 300 pounds. Supposed to be hyoid gland or something like that. I don't know about her hyoid gland, but what a fucking blimp. No shit. She looks like a fucking Thanksgiving turkey. And this one time... Will you shut the fuck up, Vern? Chris cried violently. For the last time, honest to God. He had finished his Coke, and now he turned the hourglass-shaped green bottle upside down and brandished it over Vern's head. Yeah, right, I'm sorry. Go on, Gordy. It's a swell story. I smiled. I didn't really mind Vern's interruptions, but of course I couldn't tell Chris that. He was the self-appointed guardian of art. So he's turning it over in his mind, you know, the whole week before the contest. At school, kids keep coming up to him and saying, "Hey, lardass, how many pies you gonna eat? You gonna eat 10? 20? Fucking 80? And lardass, he says, "How should I know? I don't even know what kind they are." And see, there's quite a bit of interest in the contest because the champ is this grown-up whose name is, Bill Trainer, I guess. And this guy Trainer, he ain't even fat. In fact, he's a real string bean, but he can eat pies like a whiz, and the year before he ate 6 pies in 5 minutes. "Whole pies?" Teddy asked, awestruck. "Right you are. And lardass, he's the youngest guy to ever be in the contest." "Go, lardass!" Teddy cried excitedly. "Scoff up those fucking pies. Tell him about the other guys in it," Chris said. "Okay, besides lardass Hogan and Bill Trainer, there was Calvin Spear, the fattest guy in town. He ran the jewelry store. Gretna Jewels," Vern said, and snickered. Chris gave him a black look. "And then there's this guy who's a disc jockey at a radio station up in Lewiston. He ain't exactly fat, but he's sort of chubby, you know. And the last guy was Hubert Gretna III. It was the principal of lardass Hogan's school." "He was eating against his own principal?" Teddy asked. Chris clutched his knees and rocked back and forth joyfully. "Ain't that great? Go on, Gordy." I had them now. They were all leaning forward. I felt an intoxicating sense of power. I tossed my empty Coke bottle into the woods and scrunched around a little bit to get comfortable. I remember hearing the chickadee again, off in the woods, farther away now, lifting its monotonous, endless call into the sky. Dee, 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 dee. "So he gets this idea," I said. "The greatest revenge idea a kid ever had. The big night comes. The end of Pioneer Days. The pie-eating contest comes just before the fireworks. The main street of Gretna has been closed off so people can walk around in it, and there's this big platform set up right in the street. There's bunting hanging down and a big crowd in front. There's also a photographer from the paper to get a picture of the winner with blueberries all over his face, because it turned out to be blueberry pies that year. Also, I almost forgot to tell you this, they had to eat their pies with their hands tied behind their backs. So dig it. They come up onto the platform,